Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this week's show, I'll interview the director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women about a recent assault on the rights of pregnant women, criticize MSNBC for letting lies about HIV transmission slide, and praise MSNBC for at least getting it right on abstinence-only education. Also, Michael Savage goes a little nuts thinking about gay men in uniform. For people seeking some more education on the various healthcare plans being offered by presidential candidates coming into the primary season, I'd like to recommend this interview about Senator Clinton's plan with Clinton's legislative director, Lori Rubiner. There's a couple parts to it, all done by a group collected by Our Bodies Ourselves. Here's a clip from the phone interview.
I see this as one of the seminal women's issues of the 21st century because the design of the healthcare system that we have today, which is essentially if you're not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid or elderly and qualify for Medicare or you're not a veteran, you are left to the whims of a voluntary employer-based system where your employer can decide to cover or not to cover you. And it is based on an employment model that is particularly outdated for working women. And I say that because it was designed around the post-industrial revolution when we were sort of the era of the company man, and you know, you were a man with a wife and stay-at-home wife and children, and you worked for the same company for 40 years, and you got your health care benefits through that company, and you insured your wife and your children.
It warms my heart to see this. Our Bodies Ourselves was considered a radical feminist project way out of the mainstream when it was first written in the 70s. Now it's an organization that commands the attention of major presidential candidates. The site Maddow Fans pointed to a debate on MSNBC between Valerie Huber of the Abstinence Clearinghouse and the ever-brilliant Rachel Maddow on abstinence-only education, and how yet another report, this time a congressional report, shows that it not only doesn't work to reduce STDs and unplanned pregnancy, it might actually be hurting kids. Huber tried to forbear under all the striking evidence that she was there to lie her ass off, but there were some cracks in the armor, especially when host Dan Abrams basically predicted that she'd be dodgy and dishonest from the get-go.
And you're losing on the studies.
No, that's not. That's not true. In fact, a recent study just released showed
from who?
That Virginia.
From who? You tell me what the study is. Who did the study?
Virginia's abstinence education program.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
State of Virginia.
Right.
And actually showed that teens engaged in an abstinence education program were half as likely to
Virginia, one of the states that's refused federal funding.
Whenever I evaluate myself, I turn out to be doing awesome as well.
It's a testament to Dan Abrams' professionalism that he didn't say then, ooh, burn. There's a real irony here, which is that Huber whines early that pro-choicers are using selective science, but then she turns around and argues that the mounds of independent investigations, the rising STD and teen pregnancy rates, and this congressional study can all be completely ignored in favor of a single study done by a shady anti-choice organization in Virginia. Maybe she meant she's for cherry-picking the evidence to suit her own agenda? Maddow makes the killer point about the simple issue everyone can agree on, which is that abstinence only can't even reach its stated goals and is just a waste of money, and it needs to go.
I think it's important to
listen.
There was a congressionally mandated study that looked at abstinence programs over 10 years on a national level, and it was the results of that study that told us that abstinence-only education does not work to delay or stop teens from having sex before they get married. They just don't work. And so, if abstinence doesn't work, it's a waste of money. If abstinence programs are being used to substitute for programs that actually give people usable information about contraception, STDs, and HIV, then they are killing people.
Valerie, you get the final word on this.
What's interesting is that Huber starts in on a new sales tactic for abstinence only, which is that they do teach you how to use contraception. By God, it's practically comprehensive sex education, which tells me that abstinence only proponents realize they're losing the war and they have to lie about the materials in order to sneak them under people's noses.
Actually, that's not true at all. Abstinence education is a holistic message that provides information on relationship building, accurate information on STDs, and yes, accurate information on contraception.
If your definition of accurate is distortions and lies designed to scare people out of using contraception, then she's not completely lying here. But let's take her lies on one at a time using some information about these materials compiled by CECUS. This relationship building information she's referencing. Well, since these textbooks are mainly developed from pre-existing fundamentalist Christian tracts, one might expect to see relationship advice based on stereotypes of men and women and the idea that homosexuals shouldn't exist at all. The latter is obviously there. You can't be abstinent until marriage if you can't legally marry. The CECUS review of a popular facts curricula, one of many examples, demonstrates that the book has some retrograde stereotypes about how all men want is sex and all women want is love and approval. Other curricula, like the Heritage Keepers, puts the responsibility of sexual abuse on the victims by claiming that certain kinds of immodest clothing worn by women make men uncontrollable. As for the claims to accurate information on contraception and STDs, well, here's some lies from the various curricula reviewed at CECUS. Claims that any sexual activity can spread STDs, as if you could get it from watching each other masturbate. Claims that marital sex is automatically safe from STDs. Claims that the syphilis rate is about 4 times what it is. Claims that STDs like HIV can slip through condoms, which is absolutely untrue. I could go on, but you get the point. The curricula is more about discouraging contraception use than anything else, almost as if they relish the idea of upping the unplanned pregnancy and STD rate. I'd like to welcome Lynn Paltrow, the director of the National Advocates for Pregnant Women, to the program. Lynn's here today to talk about a recent case in the battle against pregnant drug addicts that happened in Oklahoma to a woman named Teresa Hernandez, who was charged with murder for delivering a stillborn. Welcome to RealityCast, Lynn.
Thank you.
Can you explain Teresa Hernandez's case and its ramifications for women around the country?
Yes, Teresa suffered a stillbirth, as many women do. 15 to 20% of all pregnancies result in pregnancy loss, more of them earlier in pregnancy. But in her case, instead of receiving the emotional support and community support that one would hope a woman who suffered a pregnancy loss got, she was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. The basis for that claim is that her stillbirth was caused by her methamphetamine use, and that the state in Oklahoma can treat pregnancy loss, intended or unintended, as a form of murder if you can lay blame somehow on the woman. One of the important things to know is that there's no medical evidence, there's no scientific research that actually associates methamphetamine use with stillbirth. So she, in all likelihood, did nothing other than try to continue her pregnancy to term. And unfortunately, she lost that pregnancy. She's one of many women since 1977 who have been arrested on a theory that a woman can be a murderer if she suffers a stillbirth, a child abuser, if she goes ahead with her pregnancy and has some kind of untreated health problem, including an addiction.
Are there specific laws covering drug use and stillbirth?
Many of the states that have passed so-called Unborn Victims of Violence Act laws or feticide laws, occasionally prosecutions are brought under those laws, but as in Oklahoma, she was charged under the regular murder statute, and any attempt to argue that it was not intended to apply to pregnant women in relationship to their fetuses, what happens in each state is that the state then cites the Unborn Victims of Violence Act law and any other law recognizing fetal rights as a reason to apply existing murder, child abuse, or even drug delivery through the umbilical cord laws to the pregnant woman herself. Well, she recently, after sitting in jail for over 3 years without contact visits with her son, I think was worn down by the process. And although a great team had been put together on her behalf, and in spite of the fact that leading organizations, including the Oklahoma Medical Society and the Oklahoma Nurses Association and social workers, and national organizations as well, said that the charges against her should be dismissed. She could have faced a life sentence, and I think she simply couldn't bear the pressure anymore and felt that she could, that she preferred resolution to the threat of a life sentence. Her sentence has not yet occurred. That'll occur on December 21st.
There was a possibility of Hernandez prevailing, right? Why did she agree to plea?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that on a variety of levels she should have won and could have won. There is no crime. No state has made it a crime for a pregnant woman to suffer a stillbirth, no matter what the circumstances are. No state has made it a crime to try to continue your pregnancy to term in spite of whatever health problem you may have. But nevertheless, there are many women serving time in jail because they pled guilty, because they weren't adequately represented, and because they live in incredibly conservative communities. And I think there was not an unrealistic fear that no matter what the law said and no matter what the medical evidence said, she would have to be willing to bear the risk of a life sentence if the case went to trial. The other thing about these cases is in court language, there is a rule that you cannot put scientific evidence on, you can't put it in front of a jury, unless it really is scientific. And there was a case called Daubert where mothers and children tried to sue a pharmaceutical company claiming that a pharmaceutical drug named Bendectin had caused severe birth defects. And what was very interesting about that case is the Supreme Court used that case to say, look, before you can even get to trial and sue this rich pharmaceutical company, you have to show that the people that you're going to have testify about the harm that Bendectin can do have to prove that they really have done research and that it's legitimate research to have a connection between that drug and birth defects. And when it went back down and the court looked at whether they could show that their scientists had that expertise, they said, no, they don't have that expertise. The case was not even allowed to go to trial. The pharmaceutical company didn't even have to prove anything. The case was made to go away. And what's sad and frightening about cases like Ms. Hernandez's is that, in general, local doctors, local sheriffs sometimes are allowed to testify that some drug, an illegal drug or alcohol, is unquestionably the cause of harm when they should not even be allowed to testify. And so one of the problems for people who don't have access to private counsel and to the funds to do an adequate defense is that the state puts on witnesses who have no business being there. So a pharmaceutical company is protected from financial liability when a woman's liberty might be at stake simply because she can't afford to challenge the expertise of the so-called scientists or even sometimes the sheriff, who in one case was asked, we know you're not an expert, but would you want your wife doing these kind of drugs? And that was allowed in. So these are very scary things for people in terms of would we have been able to keep that evidence out? Would the jury have listened? These were risks that it was up to Ms. Hernandez to decide if she was willing to take.
What steps does the National Advocates propose to combat maternal and infant health problems resulting from drug abuse?
I think first what we would do is work with scientists and researchers. And what we're really trying to do is make clear that the biggest risk to America's babies are not their moms, that health problems that women experience and the ones that may risk bad pregnancy outcome have to do with poverty, have to do with violence against women. The actual correlation between illegal drug use and harm to children is really compared to alcohol, compared to poverty, compared to other things, it's just not there. This is not the primary threat to children. And even alcohol, there's a lot of research that still needs to be done because there are an awful lot of it takes an awful lot of alcohol and a combination with other factors for the results to be the kind of harm of fetal alcohol syndrome that people are so worried about, and rightfully so. So what can we do? We live in a country where 47 million people don't have health insurance, and those who do don't have coverage for mental health and drug treatment services. If we're serious about protecting children, protecting pregnant women and babies, then we have to make health care accessible to people. What happens in many of these cases, the prosecutor says, well, she didn't get treatment. Well, nobody without their own independent wealth can get access to appropriate and drug treatment and mental health services. And I say both because for people whose drug use really has become out of control, whether or not it's biologically acts as a teratogen on the fetus, those people need help and generally can't get it, and the drug use has become out of control because it's often associated with the history of trauma. Many, many of the women who are arrested or caught up in child welfare systems because their drug use is not casual but really has become out of control have a history of being raped as little girls, having experienced trauma, and then they can't get help for it, and then they are held accountable for not being able to get the help that they couldn't afford. And if I may just put it another way, we live in a country where pregnant women have no right to health care, no right to safe housing, no right to be protected from violence in particular. But if they can't ensure those things for the fetus within them, they somehow are increasingly thought of as criminals and bad people. So what we're doing is saying that the only form of life that is entitled to full human rights is the fetus, but not the woman who carries the fetus. And that just makes no sense in terms of being able to actually encourage and support the healthiest possible parents and communities.
If you'd like to learn more, please visit advocatesforpregnantwomen.org. Thanks for coming on a Reality Cast, Lynn.
Thanks so much for having me.
I've been doing a lot of highlighting of responsible, reality-based coverage of sexual health issues on this show, but I don't want to drop the ball on criticizing the mainstream media for repeated kowtowing to the sexphobic right-wing lies out there. Things have gotten pretty ugly in the wake of the revelation that Mike Huckabee called for the expulsion, quarantine, of AIDS patients in 1992. It's a pretty hard quote to distance yourself from, I think in part because a lot of us remember the 80s and early 90s, when a lot of right-wingers could barely conceal their loathing for AIDS sufferers. I know that I often heard this particular call to seclude patients on some island and just let them die out of sight, and that's because I lived in a pretty conservative, homophobic community back then. The most reasonable and probably only reasonable interpretation of Huckabee's comment was that he was just being another hater who saw AIDS as an excuse to shun already oppressed people. But his excuse is that people didn't really know how AIDS was spread in 1992, and he implied that there was a reason to think the spreading was similar to TB. In 1992. Which leads me to the malfeasance of the mainstream media types who are more interested in gaming the system than telling the truth. The MSNBC talking heads were out there praising him for this AIDS dodge.
I still think it's his response to it, though, that's going to be effective in a positive way. Because unlike some of the other candidates who I think are, whether it's fair or not, have an aura of being duplicitous and contrived, this guy just shoots from the hip and is like, yep, I said it. Can't help you. I'm not going to change it. It was the time. I probably would say it differently today. But he just throws it out there.
But that, so then that, under that logic, though, you could say anything as long as you were honest about it.
You know what?
You could say that dinosaurs never
roamed
the earth.
I hear you. I mean, I think there's some issues with Huckabee that we're going to have to address with him and ask him about foreign policy, because I think that's serious. And if his lack of experience in foreign policy could pose a problem as president, that's something we look at. But in terms of these issues and things he said back in 1992, the way he's handling them is brilliant. He's just charming and authentic and honest. And I think people find that more refreshing than, quite frankly, whatever views they want to hear on certain issues.
Charming? Authentic? Honest? For saying there was confusion on how HIV was transmitted in 1992? Now, in 1992, I was just an ignorant 15-year-old living in the middle of nowhere. I had a lot of ignorant beliefs. I thought you could hasten your period with hot baths. I thought REM was the best band in the world. I thought you could get herpes from a toilet seat. but I was not so stupid as to think there was any doubt in 1992 about how you got HIV. Everyone knew the drill. Unprotected sex, sharing needles, blood transfusions. If I knew that, then Mike Huckabee, who was running for Senate in 1992, has no excuse. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. We're finally getting around to a clip from the popular Wingnut radio talk show host Michael Savage. Savage was pushing a complaint that's increasingly common on the right, basically that some people, especially anyone pro-choice or pro-gay or those having unapproved opinions, should not be allowed to ask questions during presidential debates. Savage was particularly incensed that retired Brigadier General Keith Kerr should have this right, because even though Kerr served the country honorably since 1953, he is gay, and that erases everything.
With all due respect, I did not
all right, let's get turn. I don't care about this old queen, frankly. He disgusts me to make it. My flesh crawls from the old queen. That was a general? Now you wonder why I was still in Iraq 5 years later. General Keith Kerr, you know why I was still in Iraq 5 years later. That's all. He wasn't just racking up cue balls at the pool table. Okay, I'm sick of it. I'm sick of the whole country's like Rome. It's melting down like Rome.
There's not much to say to someone who says that who you sleep with at night is more important to your job performance than mere technicalities like competence or integrity.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.